You're listening to a podcast in the Cambridge Ideas series, Thinking from the University that's been changing the world for 8 centuries. Two words, credit crunch. Two words we can't avoid. We hear them from journalists, politicians, and people we meet in our daily lives. What started as a phenomenon in the financial markets has now spread to many spheres of the economy, contaminating all aspects of human interaction.
One way of trying to think about credit crunch is rather like a disease. I mean, this is the spots and the swellings and the lumps and so on the edge of our body, and obviously we have to go back inside and see what has caused this sort of thing.
In this podcast, we bring together 3 Cambridge University academics from the disciplines of history, neuroscience, and anthropology to talk about the crunch. That was Professor Alan McFarlane, an anthropologist. This is Professor Martin Daunton, an historian.
We need to think through not simply a historical analogy, but what sort of problem needs to be fixed now by what sort of institution.
And we'll also hear from Dr. John Coates, formerly a trader on the Wall Street Stock Exchange and now a senior research fellow in neuroscience and finance at Judge Business School.
We're looking at the role of hormones, and we think economics has to start accounting for the role the body plays in economic decision making.
Cambridge University's interdisciplinary environment offers unique perspectives on all the issues of our time. Issues such as the credit crunch, which we all feel in job losses, falling house prices, diminished savings, and a general sense of insecurity.
Oh, hello, welcome to Trinity Hall. Come through.
If we want to start thinking properly about the forces and processes behind those gloomy headlines, then this is the place to start.
Hi, Professor Daunton.
Professor Martin Daunton is Master of Trinity Hall, Cambridge. As a professor of economic history, he's wary of making simple comparisons between our present experience and episodes in the past.
The information from the politicians comes, I suppose, mainly from the Chancellor of the Exchequer and from the Prime Minister. And they have a big problem in trying to explain what they are doing and what it means. And I think that is where they can sometimes use history, or perhaps I should say misuse history, by making analogies.
One common analogy, of course, is the crash of 1929. And the Prime Minister has made specific reference to the economic conference held at Bretton Woods in New Hampshire in 1944. There, institutions like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund were established to prevent any future financial crises leading to the disastrous collapse that followed the Wall Street crash.
The argument at Bretton Woods was that it was necessary to solve the financial difficulties of the world which had emerged in the 1930s. There was a stock market crash in 1929, and that was then followed by the imposition of protective duties by the Americans in 1930. The British followed suit with protective duties, the Germans, the Japanese. Trade is constrained. That then also leads on to a collapse of banks. Now, Second World War comes along, and what the British and the Americans wanted to do during the war was to restart that international credit system, which meant the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and making it safe to lend to each other. So this was kick-starting, they hoped, the whole of the world financial system again. So Gordon Brown says, we need second Bretton Woods. We're going to do exactly the same now in 2009 as Roosevelt and Churchill did in 1944. It's misguided. Bretton Woods won, the Bretton Woods in 1944, only worked because it was in the middle of a world war, and it was only 2 actors, Britain and America, decided what they wanted to do, and then 44 countries met in 1944, and they all signed up to the deal. Easy. In the middle of a world war, that was possible to do. But this is, I think, a way of being misled, because history does not repeat itself. History is not something from which one simply learns lessons. Each historical episode is different. The technology is different, the speed of communication is different, people's desires are different, the relationship between the developed world and the undeveloped world is different. To take one example there, it was very possible to say at Bretton Woods, as it was said at Bretton Woods, that one way of getting recovery in the developed world is by having cheap raw materials, which meant, of course, cheap food and raw materials coming from countries which either had recently been in the empires or were still in the empires. You couldn't possibly say that now. So one has to think through what politically is possible now. And in order to understand that, we do not use historical analogy with the past. We try to understand what is going on in the present. I think mainly analogy is being used for rhetoric, to try and convince the public that you know what you're doing. I'm afraid as a historian, it gives me a lack of confidence that they know what they're doing. Simply by reaching for the shelf and saying, we could have a new Bretton Woods, is not the answer, because those institutions were created in particular historical circumstances. We need to think, what sort of institutions can be created now, given the political circumstances of the world? And moreover, think through what type of international institution is needed. The real issue now is how to control global flows of capital. And how does one do that? That might require going out to talk to scholars from different disciplines, whether it be politics or divinity. You know, we might need to understand different ways in which different religions view credit. Analogy closes down, whereas what we need to do is to open up to other disciplines.
To know more about Professor Daunton's work and any Cambridge research mentioned in these podcasts, go to www.cam.ac.uk/video and follow the links. You'll find articles, summaries, and much more. At Judge Business School, Dr. John Coates is part of a team of economists, neuroscientists and medics, which is looking into the hormone profile of city traders. He's been fascinated by the behaviour on trading floors since working as a trader himself on the New York Stock Exchange. His research has highlighted a connection between chemical changes in the human body and economic cycles of boom and bust.
In our research, we're looking at the role of naturally produced steroids on the behavior of traders and through the traders on the financial system. I was running a trading desk on Wall Street during the dot-com bubble. During that time, I noticed amongst the traders on the floor, amongst other traders on Wall Street, what I noticed is that they were displaying what might be called classic clinical symptoms of mania. They were delusional, they were euphoric, they were overconfident, they had racing thoughts, diminished need for sleep. It was strange behavior. As I say, it was clinical behavior, and it seemed like mania. What's more, these people weren't disposed to that sort of behavior. They weren't acting that way before the bubble, and they weren't acting that way after it crashed. After it crashed, they behaved like people with a hangover. So I began to suspect that maybe there was a chemical involved. There was another fact at the time that struck me and led me to ask some questions, and that was the fact that women seemed relatively unaffected by the frenzy. I figured I was on the trail of a molecule, a chemical, that affected men more than women. During that time, I had met some neuroscientists up at Rockefeller, and I came across a model that had been tested in a number of different animal species called the winner effect. In the winner effect, two male animals come together in a confrontation, either for turf or a mate or food or whatever, and in preparation for this confrontation or this fight, their testosterone levels rise. The winner comes out of this confrontation with even higher levels of testosterone. He gets a boost up in his T levels, while the loser has lower testosterone levels. What's interesting about the model is the end game, so to speak. As the testosterone levels rise in the bodies of these animals, they become not only confident and have a greater appetite for risk, they become overconfident, and their assessment of risk becomes impaired. These animals start going out in the open too much. They pick too many fights. They neglect parenting duties. They patrol areas that are too large. And as a result, they suffer an increased rate of predation. Here was a beautiful model for how winning could increase your confidence and risk preferences until eventually you were taking on too much confidence and becoming overconfident. And I thought, that's what's happening to these traders. So that was the hypothesis that we wanted to test. I went back to Cambridge, and being a former trader, it was easy for me to get back onto a trading floor. And we set about testing this hypothesis by taking salivary steroid samples from a group of traders over a period of time to see how their steroids reacted to them making and losing money.
Dr. Coates and the team were looking at the effects of two particular steroids, testosterone and cortisol.
We think that the testosterone was implicated in exaggerating a bull market to such an extent that it turns into a bubble. We were also looking at another steroid called cortisol, which is the stress hormone. Cortisol, as a stress hormone, if it stays elevated for a length of time, it has terrible effects on the body and brain. Chronically elevated levels of cortisol change the sorts of memories you recall. You tend to recall mostly negative precedents, bad things that have happened in the past in similar situations. You tend to see risk where none may exist, and you feel anxious. So we had these two steroids that we thought were building up in the bodies of traders systematically and exaggerating risk preferences across the business cycle. So they were making the peaks higher and the lows lower. In accordance with the winner effect model, we found that when traders made an above average gain trading during the day, they had above average levels of testosterone at the end of the day. The more intriguing finding was that when traders had high levels of testosterone in the morning, they went on to make a lot more money for the rest of the day. What we found with cortisol was slightly different. We were expecting cortisol to go up when traders lost money. In fact, what we found was that there was a much stronger effect, and that was coming from uncertainty. Cortisol, it's known, rises most strongly when animals or humans are put in a situation of great uncertainty. They don't know what's going to happen. Their cortisol spikes up in preparation of the unknown. When the volatility of the market increases, uncertainty increases. And we found that cortisol levels were rising enormously under those circumstances. We also found that cortisol levels went up markedly when the variance of their trading results went up. The effect size, again, was enormous. During our sampling times, we should have seen both testosterone and cortisol dropping about 50%. On some days, we saw traders' cortisol levels rise 500%. So these were enormous steroid movements in these traders. What this means for today? Well, I think the volatility both in the market and in traders' P&Ls over the past year and a half in this credit crisis, volatility has been so high that we're pretty sure that the cortisol levels of the traders would be quite elevated. And this may help explain why they are so risk averse at the moment. And so we think that right now cortisol may be playing a role in exaggerating the extent of risk aversion in the financial system.
This examination of human behavior on the trading floors of our cities suggests that we need to move away from existing economic models.
Economics, I guess, assumes that a set of facts are objective. But you can take the same set of facts and show them to somebody who is ripped on testosterone, and they will see nothing but opportunity in those facts. Show the same facts to someone who's got chronically elevated cortisol, and they're going to see nothing but risk. So the way economic agents, traders, investors, interpret information, economic statistics, really depends on which steroids are in the ascendant. We thought this hypothesis was tremendously important because up to now there's been no explanation for why these cycles of boom and crash occur so regularly without any kind of learning curve. When our first paper was published, I got email or phone calls from a lot of traders saying, I now know what's going on when I make a lot of money and then do something so stupid to give it all back. I can't figure out why I did it afterwards. They go overconfident and think that anything they do will turn out right. They can put on any trade, they feel invincible. Any trade will work out right. And it's like those animals who are going out in the open too much or picking too many fights. There's a day of reckoning. A lot of people ask what the policy implications of this research are. And we think that if, in fact, it's true, and certainly our data suggests it is, that the possibility exists that stock market bubbles are a male phenomenon. And if that is the case, then the way to dampen volatility in the financial world is to have more women and older men on the trading floors. I think if the financial world had a more diversified hormonal profile, then we would have a much more stable financial system.
Now you know who this is. Now I know.
That sounds interesting. Anyway, it's nice to have something a bit different.
Yeah.
Okay, this is a G staircase, it's four staircases, E, F, G, H. So you're in G, G2, Professor McFarlane.
Alan McFarlane is Professor of Anthropology at King's College. His interest is in the way people interact with one another in trading markets and elsewhere, and also in the way they relate to a world of virtual credit and virtual money. He identifies a need to believe and trust in the system to keep it from collapsing.
The world economy will not work without these huge amounts of credit floating around. It would just seize up. We need that. On the other hand, it cannot be secured. All attempts of governments like the United States and elsewhere to pump money into the economy or to say that they will guarantee the banks and so on are so many words. They really cannot guarantee or back up this amount of money. It's virtual money and it's virtual credit. It doesn't really exist, and it's only in our minds. And as soon as our minds say it doesn't really exist, it's like Tinkerbell. As soon as the children stopped believing in Tinkerbell, she died. And as soon as we stop believing in this stuff, it dies. So basically all it rests on, and has done for some time, is trust.
And trust, as both a concept and an institution, is particularly important in the foundations of British and American culture.
The trust originally was a financial device to avoid paying large sums of money to the king, to avoid inheritance duties. And so you set up a trust, which is a group of people who would look after your estate, and when you died, they would pass it on to someone else. And it started in a very restricted way. And Henry VIII realized that this was a threat to the state because they were losing revenues, and he tried to get rid of it, but he failed. It then formed the basis for most of the institutions that made the modern world. For instance, the nonconformist sects, the small religious groups which brought us religious freedom, like the Methodists and the Quakers, were set up as trusts so they could avoid being destroyed by the Catholic or Anglican powers. So modern religious freedom comes out of the trust and the trusting idea. The major financial institutions, the Bank of England, the Stock Exchange, Lloyd's Insurance, were set up as a trust and remained trusts. But it then has another effect outside the actual institutions which it spawns, which is that if you act in this way in these groups and associations, you then find yourself thinking and trusting. It builds up an atmosphere of trust. One of the oddnesses of English social structure and American social structure has been that it's always been very trusting. A person's word is their bond. And this has grown up for centuries in this country, but it's rather unusual when you compare it to other places. A lot of capitalism is based on that because you haven't got time and you have to trust the other person. Someone says, invest in that, and you trust them. You trust your stockbroker and so on. As we're talking, I'm beginning to wonder whether credit should be replaced by trust. It's not the credit crunch, it's a trust crunch.
As an anthropologist, Professor McFarlane has spent his career studying societies around the world, which means that he's able to think about how different attitudes to trust affect the global economy.
I'd get into trouble if I said that England and America are the only place that have trust. I mean, much of the continent, and there are pockets and pools of it in every society. I suppose perhaps one of the difficulties now is that each civilization as it grew up had patterns of ensuring stable relations and trust, but they're all rather different. And again, globalization in the last 10 or 15 years has meant that they've all suddenly had to mesh together. So someone from China or Japan trying to deal with someone in America or France is trying to deal with other models of trust and cooperativeness. And it's pretty likely that this will break down quite quickly. The other problem now is with the economic system of the world gone global and totally seamless and interconnected, the political system hasn't. And there is no proper international legal system. Therefore, if you get people reneging between disparate regimes of trust in different countries, who are you going to appeal to? There's no redress at all because there's no international court of chancery, so to speak, to sue them in. So until we really come to terms with the fact that the economic growth has really outstripped our political and legal growth in this world, this sort of thing is likely to continue.
One remedy proposed by political leaders to our current financial ailments is to consume more, something which Professor McFarlane isn't convinced by.
That seems only a very partial solution because we can't just go on doing that. I imagine that what we will all have to do is to reassess the patterns of our lives, for example, to spend less on consuming physical things like food and clothes and so on, and spend more on consuming non-physical things like beauty and art. Gradually one has to re-examine, and I think this is already beginning to happen. A lot of people are moving from extreme consumerism towards searching for interesting things to do, to, you know, arts and games and sports and designing and all sorts of things. A lot of this kind of activity is actually collaborative and cooperative. Games, sports, most group activities and leisure is very trusting, and it breeds trust and it depends on trust, so that if this is stimulated and grows and becomes something that gives many people a lot of meaning in their lives and enriches them, then it again will lead to the growth of trust in other people.
You've been listening to a podcast in the Cambridge Ideas series.